Dopamine is the neurotransmitter that orients us to making the future better. One of the things that distinguishes the future from the present is that the future is not real. The only thing that's real is what's happening right now at this moment. We've got the hedonist. And this is the person who all they want to do is they want to go out to clubs, they want to get drunk, they want to eat junk food, they want cheap hookups. That's one picture of someone who's got too much dopamine. Another picture is someone who looks very different on the surface, but in many ways they're the same, and that's the type A workaholic, the person who is incapable of enjoying the present moment, and they're always worrying about the future. What's the next promotion? What's the next deal going to be? We look at these billionaire entrepreneurs, and we see their beautiful houses, and their beautiful girlfriends, and their beautiful yachts, and we envy them. The person who's most able to afford the beach house is least able to enjoy it.
Who would humans be? What would we be without dopamine?
I think that that's a pretty easy answer. We'd be extinct. Experiments have been done where lab animals, I believe rats, have been bred without dopamine receptors in the brain. And they just sit around all day. They don't pursue food. They don't pursue any goals at all. And they essentially starve to death unless they are fed.
I read a great essay yesterday that made me think of you and your work. And one of the lines in that essay was the idea that in modern life, people are, quote, donating our dopamine to our phones rather than to our friends. I'd like to give some space in this conversation today to talk about your perspective on the way that dopamine is being perhaps twisted and used in ways that people may not be really aware of in modern society and modern culture. I'd like to put that to you as a just baseline point of whether you agree with that general sentiment in when you look around the world today, when you look at your community and the country in general, if you see that people are donating this incredible component of their personality and their life to products and digital technology that they may not really be aware of how much it's affecting them potentially negatively. You can take that however you'd like, but I know that was something I wanted to talk to you about.
Yeah. I think that there is a lot of truth in that. Dopamine is just one way that we get pleasure and gratification out of life. Dopamine's future oriented. It's what can this do for me? And so when we're stuck to our phones, we're really searching for things that apply to us. If it's social media, maybe it's a like or a repost or something like that. So that's going to boost our ego a little bit. Maybe it's products we want to buy. Maybe it's things we aspire to or things that make us feel better about ourselves. But it's always looking to the future. Let's make something better. How can I become better liked, more famous, have more money, have more stuff? And it really robs us of the ability to enjoy the present moment. When we're with friends, sometimes we are working on dopamine. Maybe we're planning where we're going to go out. Maybe we're thinking about buying something cool. But in many other situations, it has nothing to do with the future at all. We're just hanging out. We're just enjoying one another's company. And in that kind of a situation, dopamine gets turned off. And I don't think we experience enough of that in modern life.
Yeah. It may have been wise for me to start the conversation by just asking the baseline question of what dopamine is. You go into the book in dispelling some of the misconceptions oftentimes of what people believe dopamine is versus what it actually is. So please take as much time as you'd need to give a lay audience a general explanation as to what dopamine really is, what role it plays in human life.
Yeah. I think that when most people think about dopamine, they think it's about its reward function, sex and drugs and rock and roll. and that's fine. That's what's most fun about dopamine, but it's only part of the picture. And I think that really in order to understand the role that dopamine plays in our life, we've got to understand more than just the reward function. As I mentioned earlier, dopamine is the neurotransmitter that orients us to making the future better, maximizing future resources. And so sex and drugs and rock and roll, that's about immediate gratification. And dopamine definitely plays a role in that, making us crave junk food, alcohol, drugs of abuse, hookups, that sort of thing. But dopamine is also able to look farther into the future. And when it does that, it utilizes a different part of the brain. The reward function is very deep in the brain, and it's shared with many, many other animals. But when we look out farther, we're using our frontal lobes. And that's the part of the brain that is most developed in human beings. And in the frontal lobes, dopamine does a number of very, very interesting things. One thing it does is it allows us to suppress dopamine in the deeper structures. So it's dopamine acting against dopamine. And that's because I may see a donut and I may say, wow, I'd love to have that donut. Dopamine deep in my brain becomes active. But then dopamine in my frontal lobe says, well, you know, you might enjoy it for a few minutes, but it's not really good for you. So I think you should not eat that donut. So that's one thing it does. It says no. And by the way, attention deficit disorder is an illness in which people don't have healthy activity of dopamine in their frontal lobes. Mm. And one of the symptoms is that they're impulsive. They're not able to inhibit those urges that come from the reward dopamine, and they just go for it without really thinking. Another thing that dopamine in the frontal lobes does, which people with ADD have difficulty with, is focus and concentration. It allows us to exclude things that are irrelevant and just focus on what it is that is most important for us at that moment. And finally, what it does is it allows us to use abstract concepts. And let me just take a step back on that for a moment. One of the things that distinguishes the future from the present is that the future is not real, right? It's imaginary. The only thing that's real is what's happening right now at this moment. Future is full of possibilities. So it's very good for our survival to be able to think about the future, to be able to plan, to make contingencies. And so evolution did give us that ability. And along with the ability to think about the future that doesn't exist, we also got the ability to think about other things that don't exist. Things like math, the laws of nature, justice, beauty, art, all of those things. So that was a pretty nice bonus that came along with dopamine in the frontal lobes. And it's really what's enabled us to master our environments the way we have.
Yeah, I've heard you talk about how there seems to be a genetic component to this in people as well, that some people just seem to have a natural wiring where they have more dopamine than others. And please correct me if I'm misrepresenting your views on this, but what if that's correct, what are the symptoms? I'm sure people can conjure up people in their own life that they know that may have these qualities, but what are the signs of an individual that is probably clearly high in these qualities because of how they're living, how they're thinking? You can kind of get that out of them when you're interacting with them.
Since dopamine does different things in the brain, I'm going to paint different pictures of people who have excessive dopamine activity. So if we start with sex and drugs and rock and roll, we've got the hedonist. And this is the person who all they want to do is they want to go out to clubs, they want to get drunk, they want to eat junk food, they want cheap hookups. That's one picture of someone who's got too much dopamine. Now, another picture is someone who looks very different on the surface, but in many ways they're the same, and that's the type A workaholic, the person who is incapable of enjoying the present moment, and they're always worrying about the future. What's the next promotion? What's the next deal going to be? And they sacrifice family, friends, hobbies, because all they're doing is focusing on their work. And I don't want to say that's necessarily a bad thing. These people are wonderful for society. These are the entrepreneurs like Steve Jobs, who are just absolutely obsessed with creating things and making them better. And they're absolutely wonderful for society, but unfortunately, they tend to be unhappy. We look at these billionaire entrepreneurs and we see their beautiful houses and their beautiful girlfriends and their beautiful yachts, and we envy them. And we don't need to do that because most of them are miserable. they can't let go. We say that the person who's most able to afford the beach house is least able to enjoy it. Mm. Right? She's out at the pool with her laptop on the phone with people at work, completely oblivious to those beautiful tropical breezes that are rustling her hair. So that's the second one. The third one is the creator who is obsessed with their creation. This could be an artist. It could be an inventor. It could be some other kind of creative person. And this is the kind of person who will be in their studio working on their project, and they don't sleep. They don't eat. They don't shower. Nothing in the world exists except their project. And these people are also very, very good for society. And they also do tend to be unhappy. We hear a lot about artists committing suicide, being depressed, getting divorced, because they just sacrifice their life to this one thing. And one of the characteristics of dopamine is that because it's always focused on the future, it can never be satisfied, because satisfaction takes place in the present moment. So nothing is ever good enough. They work, they sacrifice, they achieve, and they go, not good enough. Buzz Aldrin is someone, we use an example in the book of someone with lots of dopamine. And when he got back from the moon, someone asked him, what was it like walking on the moon? I mean, that's unimaginable, walking on that shining sphere in the sky. And he said, it's just something we did. Now we should do something else. So they accomplish a lot. They often get rich and famous, but we don't want to be like that because it's a very hard existence.
I want to have at least part of this conversation be about, you know, wisdom. And I'm sure you've thought almost as much as anybody in the world about how people like this might come across your work and your book and tweak their lifestyle if they do feel dissatisfied, if they do feel like they have this insatiable quality in them that's leading to their own misery, despite the fact that they have these successes in the world. What would you point people to in terms of things to consider, habit changes, lifestyle changes? I know in the book you go into some detail about the down chemicals that are serotonin, endorphin, oxytocin, which are sort of the, you know, a close cousin, but sort of an inverse to dopamine. Again, you can take that however you would like, but for people, if you had a friend who inhibited or possessed a lot of these personality qualities and came to you and asked you for advice, and I don't, maybe you identify as somebody who's very high dopamine as well, how would you point them to a life that includes more, you know, probably gratitude, peace, appreciation for probably for many of them and this amazing life that they've cultivated for themselves?
Yeah. Yeah. So before I answer that question, let me just take a moment to emphasize how hard it is to change.
Yeah.
You know, there's an old joke. How many psychiatrists does it take to change a light bulb? Just one, but the light bulb's got to want to change. it's difficult. I'm very dopaminergic. I suspect you are too. That's why you've got this wonderful podcast. people who are very dopaminergic do come to me sometimes and say, I don't know why I'm unhappy. I've got everything. You know, I've got a wonderful career. I've got a beautiful house. I've got a loving wife and I'm miserable. And the answer is, well, it's because you're always focused on the future and you never enjoy the present. You need to work less and spend more time with family and friends. And they look at me in absolute horror. And they say, well, that's not going to happen because my job is so important. If I work less, I'm going to get fired. You know, I struggled my whole life to get where I am today. And you're asking me to just let that fall apart. So it's very, very difficult because change involves sacrifice and change involves pain. And we rarely embrace sacrifice and pain unless we absolutely have to. So in some ways, it's almost like an addiction. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, they have this belief that people need to hit rock bottom before they consider giving up their drug of abuse. Otherwise, they just say, "Doc, take away my problems, but don't take away the chemical. You know, leave me with the alcohol or the cocaine. Just get rid of this bad stuff." And it's hard for them to accept that that's not possible, that they've got to give up the thing that's closest to their heart, whether it's a drug or whether it's the feeling of accomplishment or the feeling of safety and security they get by constantly working for a safer future. So I would say the first step, and probably the hardest step, is to want to do it so badly that you're willing to make these sacrifices. And somewhat ironically, we need dopamine for this, because dopamine is the neurotransmitter of desire. So just like long-term thinking opposes immediate gratification, we need dopamine to promote balance and opposing fanaticism, if that's the right word. And so I'll tell them, write down what it is that you don't like about your life. Write down times when you were genuinely happy. And this doesn't mean like getting a big deal, because maybe you get happy for a few minutes, maybe a few days, but things that really led to enduring happiness. And what people find is that it's not about accomplishment. It's usually about being with people that they care about, or, you know, working on a hobby. That's not going to get them any money. It's not going to get them a promotion at work, but it's just nice, whether it's woodworking or painting or gardening, whatever it is. Everybody's going to be different. And so I can't tell people what to do. I can tell you what I'm trying to do. When I was writing this book, it dawned on me, wow, I am really unbalanced in terms of dopamine. And so the first thing I tried to do was to be in the present moment when I was with my family and friends, to truly listen to what they were saying without thinking about what I wanted to say next or thinking about something completely unrelated, like what I'm going to make for dinner that night. And I don't know if you've ever tried that, but at least for me, it's unbelievably difficult. I can do it if I try really, really hard, I can probably do it for about 10 seconds. And then my mind wanders and I've got to pull it back. So I started with that. I've been meditating. I've been meditating now for about 5 years. I still can't do it. And I think that that's everybody's experience. I'm being kind of joking here. The purpose of meditation, you know, they say clear your mind and focus on your breathing or something like that. Purpose of meditation is to fail, because every time you fail and you catch yourself and you bring your attention back to your breathing or whatever it's on, you're strengthening your ability to direct your mind into good places. So I'm trying that. During COVID, I started working from home, and instead of a 45-minute commute to work every day, I took a walk in the woods and I tried to be in the present moment. And again, very, very hard. So I think the key is that we've got to acknowledge how difficult it is and we've got to be patient. I've been working on this for 5 years. I've made some progress. I'm a little bit more patient, got a longer fuse, but change is very, very slow.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. And I wonder if, you know, outside of yourself or maybe including yourself, if you have seen evidence that, you know, this change really is possible. It's very tough to fight your genes. And if you have a certain wiring, and I think you're right. I identify with a lot of what you just said. It can be difficult to really course correct and turn the cruise ship around in a very different direction. Do you typically find that this takes, you know, a lot of work and years of sustained habit changes to change, you know, because I would imagine the overall goal is to help people have a better life, probably a life that is palpably more peaceful and filled with appreciation and gratitude. I don't know if you would agree with that, but have you seen examples in your friend group and people you've met and yourself of, you know, some evidence that this really people can not maybe totally change, but have some adjustments where they're not as insatiable as they once were?
Yeah. You know, I often tell my patients there are no shortcuts in life.
Yeah.
But there is a shortcut here. It's not a very nice shortcut, but it's a very effective one. And that is tragedy. Hmm. Tragedy is a very effective catalyst for change. Some years ago, my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer. And she was like me, you know, hard charging, very, very interested in work. That was her main thing. And cancer, as it does for many, many people, made her take a step back and reevaluate her life. Thank God she had wonderful doctors and she went into remission. And she said, I don't have much time left. I realize now. And I need to stop constantly pushing for a better future and say, you know what? Future's here. I need to slow down. I need to ask myself what's meaningful about my life. And I need to focus on the meaning, my family, my friends, and just doing stupid things that make me happy. You know, and I think we see that a lot in cancer patients. The ones who survive say that it made them have more gratitude for life, for their relationships. It made them slow down and smell the flowers. And I think that other forms of tragedy can do that as well. Parents who give birth and have a child with some kind of developmental disability that completely reshapes their life. And it's a terrible tragedy for them, but in many cases, it enriches their life. And in the long term, it makes it better. So, you know, we all do everything we can to avoid tragedy. We save money for a rainy day. We eat healthy so we don't get sick. We exercise. But the funny, ironic fact of life is that sometimes the greatest blessing that we experience is something that just tears up our life and makes us take a fresh look at what's going on.
Yeah. God, that's so well put. One of my favorite quotes, which I came across years ago, is that the modern devil is cheap dopamine. Yeah. And God knows I see that in myself. In many ways, I think the major quality of life improvements that I've obtained in the last 5 years have been from removing habits rather than adopting new habits. It's mostly been from cutting out crap from my life that doesn't really matter and is not serving me particularly well. A lot of that includes, you know, exposure to technology. I'd love to open up a little bit of space to talk about the role that you were talking earlier, I think, basically about workaholism and the addictiveness of that quality and people that, you know, are often encouraged to do that in our country, at least. When you look around our country, in your friend group, in just the zeitgeist in America, what do you see are examples, if any, of that, the spirit of that quote, of the fact that, you know, for people that do have so much dopamine coursing through them, this is one of the most exciting and one of the most impossible times to be alive. It takes a monkish level of discipline and effort oftentimes to resist all of the temptations that are out there. What do you see? What else have you noticed that, and maybe it's just it's worthy of additional commentary about workaholism, if that's the primary one that you notice. But I know you write a lot about the addictive qualities of what's available on a smartphone. And I just know in my own life, when I was growing up in my family, it was unacceptable to watch television while having dinner. There were boundaries that were set by my parents about preserving family time. And, you know, now everybody has their smartphone out at the dinner table. It's sort of as though everybody has collectively gotten addicted to the new cigarettes and no one has yet realized how it's affecting so much of life these days. Again, you can take that however you'd like, but I'd love to get any additional commentary you may have on modern life and how cheap dopamine may be not particularly serving us well.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that if you look at the strategies that companies use to sell their products, it's really been evolving, and it all revolves around dopamine. So, you know, in the 50s, the advertiser said sex sells. And that's when we started seeing scantily clad women in advertisements. And of course, that's an appeal to the dopamine system. Newspaper reporters said, if it bleeds, it leads. Violence also stimulates our dopamine system. That's pretty primitive, but it's gotten a lot more sophisticated. The things that stimulate dopamine the most are the things that are about us, because that's what's going to impact our future in the most dramatic ways. So just to give you an example, you know, imagine reading the newspaper and you're reading about some trade pact. You're probably bored out of your mind, maybe you got nothing else to do. There's no dopamine going on. But if suddenly you come across a passage and it turns out that one of the trade negotiators is a guy you went to high school with, you're going to get some dopamine, because now it's salient is the technical term. You keep reading the article and you see your name in the article, you're going to get a huge blast of dopamine. And so what companies have done is they've tried more and more to make their products about you, because that's what stimulates dopamine and that's what keeps you engaged. And it used to be that, you know, in order for us to accomplish something, we had to work very, very, very hard. And there was no guarantee. You know, if I wanted to make the dean's list at school, I had to study my ass off. If I wanted to win a race, I had to train every single day. Now, it's so easy to get a like. It's so easy to get a follow or a repost. And that stimulates dopamine. And it really taps into some very deep survival mechanisms inside of the brain. And so these companies, these social media companies, these video game companies, these purveyors of pornography, they have neuroscience experts working for them. It's not an accident that they're stimulating dopamine. They are specifically going after it, and they're finding better and better ways to do it. I love the way you compared this to smoking cigarettes, because I think that ultimately the solution is going to be similar to the solution to the smoking problem. We've done a very good job. You know, there's still a lot of work to do. A lot of people still smoke. And psychiatrists like me, we're always asking patients if they'd like some help. But overall, smoking has dropped a great deal. And the reason for that is that it became socially unacceptable to smoke, right? First, you had to go outside and do it, and now you can't even do that. You know, if somebody sees you smoking a cigarette on the corner, they're going to look at you and they're going to say, wow, this person is uneducated. This person lacks self-control. This person is overindulgent. And so you just don't do it. And I think we're going to need to get there with our phones. You just don't pull out your phone at the dinner table or when you're with another person. We're going to get social limits, and I think that's going to be a big help.
Yeah. I don't know how much you thought about this, but that's a great example. But in your mind, to continue on the theme of wisdom, these are amazing tools that also unlock incredible information and opportunities for people. What is the rough, maybe just in your own life, like what do you think is the, if we were talking about this 2 or 3 decades from now, when there's been more of a shift where people are recognizing that there have to be limits placed on this, how do you think, if we evolve in a wise direction, what kind of limits do you think will be commonplace in the culture? What do you think is the right dosage, the right amount to exposure and usage for maybe just the smartphone specifically.
Mm-hmm. I think that maybe we can think about it in terms of food. You know, there's a lot of talk these days about ultra processed food, also called hyper palatable food. Pretty much 90% of the stuff that you see on grocery store shelves. And, you know, there's some people who primarily eat that, and most of them are overweight, have high blood pressure, elevated blood sugar, and they're not well. And then other people make a real effort to eat whole foods, fruits, vegetables, meat, whole grains, that sort of thing. And they feel a lot better. But, you know, it's not healthy to be a fanatic about what you eat. You go to a birthday party, you have a piece of cake, right? You go to a baseball game, you have a hot dog, you know, but it's a special occasion. And so I think it needs to be like that, where the phone is not the first thing that we turn to. It's a very, very powerful tool that we know is very dangerous. And so we use it carefully. You know, maybe we use it like a firearm. You know, we don't just wave firearms around. These are powerful tools. You know, we take them to war to kill people. We give them to policemen to protect us. We go hunting with them. But we're really, really careful with them because we know that anything this powerful can be very, very destructive. And maybe the time will come where we're going to recognize phones as being up there in terms of some of the most dangerous things that we own.
Yeah, that's so well put. One of the other things I think you write about that's so important is the role of dopamine in relationships and love. And, you know, this is somewhat, I think, related to the addictiveness that some of the modern dating apps and opportunities can kind of short circuit people and derail them from what was the original objective of meeting someone that they want to be with. I'd love to give you some space to talk through, you know, your current thinking about, you kind of separate, in my estimation of your analysis of, you know, courtship and long-term relationships into the initial 9 to 12 month phase, and then the longer term, more, you know, endorphin cuddle-ish relationships that are based on serotonin and some of the down chemicals. I'd love to give you as much time as you would like to describe your current thinking about those two systems in the brain and what we know about how they form you know, longer term relationships, and maybe most importantly, how that can misfire for people that are high in dopamine or who have this insatiable tendency in them to just be searching and never be you know, appreciating or benefiting from their efforts. Again, you please feel free to take that however you would like, but I wanted to give you some space to talk about that.
Yeah. So, you know, the experience of falling in love is probably one of the most intensely pleasurable experiences that we have in life. It raises us above common humanity and makes us feel like we are in some paradise. It's an absolutely wonderful feeling, but it's time limited, as you mentioned. It only goes on average for about 9 to 12 months. I've spoken to some people it's gone on for 2 years, but that's rare. But whatever it is, it's going to come to an end. And when that happens, a lot of people make the mistake of saying, oh gosh, it turns out that this wasn't the right person after all. And they leave that person and they go out looking for the next dopaminergic thrill. I had a patient like this many years ago, and his interest in relationships was pure dopamine. And he's a very charming, charismatic guy. And so he got lots and lots of women, but he had a problem. And that was that he wanted to have a long-term relationship, but as soon as he had sex with these women, he completely lost interest in them because the conquest was over. It was actually the conquest that he was chasing. And the next thing that happened was that he would meet them in a bar, he would chat them up, he would invite them back to his apartment, and all of this was exciting and dopamine, and they'd say yes. And boom, dopamine would crash because, okay, the conquest was now over and he completely lost interest. He didn't even want to bring them back to his apartment anymore. And that's when he came to see me. When the passionate phase, the dopamine phase of love wears off, it can evolve into something that is not as intensely pleasurable, but might arguably be better. And that's companionate love. That companionate from friend. That's when you're just with someone and your life is deeply entwined with theirs. They know you better than anybody else. You trust them. They've always got your back. They're always supportive of you. They're always trying to lift you up. And that's the kind of love that leads to, you know, these decades-long marriages in which both partners are just so deeply satisfied. And that's not dopamine. That's oxytocin and serotonin and endorphin and endocannabinoid. Those are the here and now chemicals of pleasure, as opposed to the thrill of dopamine. I have a patient right now, a young lady who is in a situation that many women, she's in her 30s, and she has really devoted herself to her career. And now she wants to find somebody to have a long-term relationship with. So she goes on the dating apps. And the first pitfall she encountered was, you know, men would be interested in her. And there was a number, how many men had, I don't know, swiped right or whatever it is that they do with her. And all she wanted to do was make that number go up. She lost interest in the individual men, and she just wanted that number to go up and up and up. She quickly realized that that was a problem, and she went away from that. She found some men she was attracted to, and she dated them, and it was very exciting, but they were all bad boys. That got her dopamine going for one reason or another, but they all treated her very poorly. They lied to her. They carried on other relationships while they said that they were interested in her, and it never went anywhere. Then she met a guy who's a really nice guy, and she recognized this man was honest, trustworthy, reliable. He cared about her. He was careful with money. He was thinking about the future. And she really, really liked him, and she really liked the way he made her feel, but she wasn't passionate about him, right? And so she came in saying, well, isn't passion necessary? And I'm like, don't go out and find another one of those bad boys. And I tried to explain to her that passion's going to make her happy for a year, but somebody like this could make her happy for half a century. And so she stuck it out. And fortunately, as she got to know him better, the passion came. And so she got everything. But as you say, we don't want to fall into a trap in which we think that passionate love is the only kind of love. You know, passionate love is the kind of love they make movies about and write books about. But it's not the kind of love that makes people happy over the course of a lifetime. That's going to be companionate love.
It's crazy because this is arguably one of the most important pieces of information in the world if you want to have that kind of a relationship, and no one ever talks about this, or there's certainly no very little education that I ever received about distinguishing between the two. And in the absence of that, I think it makes a lot of sense why people would believe after roughly a year that this is a failing relationship. And I'd love any additional commentary you may have on the skills that if someone is really serious about having a longer term relationship, that they may want to cultivate in themselves to be able to make that transition without, you know, the despair of a pseudo addict of needing to go back for another fix. And what advice you would give to, you know, you were talking about your two patients there, maybe the first guy who was charming and bringing a lot of women back to his apartment, how you would guide someone like that. There's a quote I've always loved, which is, don't practice what you don't want to become. And I think if you've repeated that system for so long, it's just, it's like an addiction. It can be very difficult to shift that. I don't know if you have any other comments on that, but I'd love to hear it if you might.
Yeah. You know, you're right that we don't talk about it. And it's strange because this is so central to happiness. This was something that was taking care of us in the past. So, for example, in many cultures, they had and still do today arranged marriages. And so the idea of passionate love really was not an issue. You were connected with someone and you were expected to make it work. And then we had, you know, marriages that were based on love. But then, you know, you didn't have sex before marriage. So you had all of this passion. You got married. Year later, the passion's gone. But tough luck, you're married. And in the old days, divorce was not a thing. And so you work it out. And people can work it out. I don't know if you ever saw the movie The Odd Couple.
I've heard of it. I've never seen it.
Yeah, great movie. I love that movie. Anyway, two very, very different people who get on each other's nerves, want to kill one another. But for one reason or another, they've got to stay together. And it turns into a very deep, very beautiful friendship. And so if you are forced to be with someone, in many cases, it will actually work out. But, you know, over time, there's been less and less of that cultural pressure to stay together. So divorce became more common, and then divorce became less stigmatized. I think in Europe, it's become kind of uncommon to even get married. That two people will come together, they'll have children, they'll buy a house together, and they'll never even bother to get married. Maybe because there are tax disadvantages or something. You know, now with hookup culture, you don't even have boyfriends and girlfriends anymore. It's just people that you sleep with. And so I think that on the surface, not making commitments to people and just floating here and there, depending on what gives you the most pleasure, feels like a form of freedom, but it is not. In fact, it's a form of slavery. And the reason for that is that human beings have human nature, and we have to deal with that. And human nature is not, oh, I'm completely free, I can do whatever I want, therefore I'm happy. Human nature needs to have guardrails. It needs to have supports from culture, from society, from friends and family, so that we don't go off those rails. And today we're getting just the opposite. We're getting encouragement to go off the rails. Express yourself in any way you want to, because that is your authentic self. And if you look at the people who are doing this, they're very, very unhappy.
Yeah. This is how I can tell in some areas of life. I've always considered myself a very liberal person, but that I'm getting conservative in the classical sense of conserving components of life that are fraying and disappearing. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how you see, if you do at all, these, you know, the people that think, you know, that have this attitude that they're, and I identify with a lot of this too, so I'm not passing judgment, that there is, their freedom is really helping them when they're actually becoming more miserable. Do you get a sense that there will be inevitably a shift back to, I mean, a lot of this advice is like things that your grandmother would have told you, that we are on the cusp of culturally a return to earlier cultural values and principles that people used to live by, as people feel more and more lost, as people feel like they have fewer guardrails. I had Barry Schwartz on the show about a year ago, who wrote The Paradox of Choice, and I've thought about that conversation in that book a lot. Anyways, just wanted to put that to you and get your sense of where, if you think there is a pendulum on its way to swing back in another direction?
I think that the pendulum has swung for some subgroups. There's a lot of interest in eating better, you know, putting away the hyper palatable food. There's interest in physical fitness. People are spending more time in the gym. They're spending more time outside. But it's unevenly distributed. You know, it's mainly present in people who are more affluent, better educated, whereas a lot of people are still stuck in this habit of buying fast food, sitting in front of screens instead of doing things in the real world. So, I think that eventually it could, but I think that there is a wild card out there that we need to acknowledge, and that's the rise of artificial intelligence. In order for us to live healthy, satisfying lives, we have to face challenges. Just like bodybuilders need resistance to grow, you can't build muscles if you don't have resistance. Human beings need adversity in order to grow in a moral, spiritual, and personal way. And one of the problems with modern life is that adversity is going away. We no longer have to hunt down woolly mammoths in order to survive. We no longer have to build shelter with our hands. We no longer have to push a plow behind an ox. Things are getting easier and easier and easier. And artificial intelligence is going to take that very, very far. I think it's going to take us to a place when we all have the ability to behave like children if we want to. Another patient of mine, his father grew up in a very affluent household with parents who spoiled him. And so he never faced any challenges. He was a CD student. His parents said, that's okay. You got a trust fund. Who cares what grades you get? Never had a job in his life, just lived off this trust fund, never wanted anything, because anything he wanted, he could buy. And my patient loved his father. And they had a good relationship, but he couldn't look up to him as a mentor. He couldn't see him as a role model. His father was like a child. And I think that sooner than we imagine, we're all going to be affluent trust fund babies in the sense that, the world of scarcity is going to go away. We're going to have robots in factories producing goods that are incredibly cheap. We're going to have artificial intelligent assistants who schedule our dentist appointments and order our groceries and prepare our meals. And again, we're going to say, oh my God, wonderful freedom. I don't have to work. I don't even have to wipe my butt, right? I can have anything that I want. What could be better? And it's going to be a horrible thing for the human race.
I want to talk a little bit about how you think this is affecting and might affect men specifically. One of the most interesting and important conversations I've had on this podcast was with Richard Reeves, who wrote of Boys and Men, which is essentially an analysis of the state of men. These are massive data sets and these are averages, but essentially the big takeaway from the book is that men are disconnected, are less educated. These are young, the up and coming generation, less educated, just are not doing very well as a collective in our culture. And then you pile on top of that what you just said of what might be coming our way and how these guys are going to be able to take it even easier if they want to. Some of that is a miracle, and I think it has its place, but I don't know how much you've thought about this as it relates to men or if you have sons. But I always like to ask that question because I get the sense that a lot of men, unlike a lot of women, are feeling, this is true with women too, but are feeling very isolated. Men are, I think, more apt to self-isolate and to go it alone. And I remember one of the most salient points that Richard was making in the conversation I had with him was related to deaths of despair. And it's something like it's four or five times as many men are dying from opioid overdoses as women. And the point he was making is that a big reason why they're dying is that there's no one there. There's no one around them. They don't have friends. That's not a party drug. That's a drug you do by yourself, probably because you're suffering. It's a long way of segueing into this, but I'd love to get any thoughts you may have on how you think this might affect men, and most importantly, how you think men may be able to change their lives or change their habits in order to help themselves.
Yeah. It's a big, big topic. Very, yeah. Very complicated. Just to start, yes, I do have sons. I've got two boys. And, you know, I may be biased, but I think they're absolutely amazing people. Yeah. And when they were kids in lower school, I was just amazed at their creativity, their motivation, their interest. You know, I'd go to school for the parent-teacher conferences, and I wouldn't necessarily hear good things. Your son is disorganized. Your son has trouble sitting still. Your son jokes around when it's time to be serious. Your son sometimes doesn't follow the rules. And I'm kind of like, yeah, because he's a boy. What I realized is that the feminine virtues are rewarded in schools in our society. The ability to sit quietly, the ability to follow directions, the ability to pay attention, the ability to get along with everybody. That made it very hard for them. And I think that we do see that throughout society as a result of society moving away from manual labor and moving towards more cognitive labor. And, you know, with computers picking up a lot of cognitive labor, we move away from, you know, skills that boys are a little bit better at, math, engineering, and more toward the soft skills of interacting with other people, which on average, and I don't want to make generalizations, but on average, women are better at. And so men don't really have a place like they used to. And they are isolated because, you know, when you no longer needed to go out to hunt woolly mammoths to survive, well, men would do other things that would sort of simulate that. Maybe they'd hunt deer. Maybe they put together, you know, a baseball team. Sports is kind of a form of hunting. Or maybe they would have a group and they'd go out and do charitable works. You know, they'd fight against poverty and make people happy. And so there were these men's clubs in which they did it. And those really have disappeared for the most part for a few reasons. One is that that some of these men's clubs, inevitably business would get done. And women felt that that put them at a disadvantage in the workplace. Business was being done in a place they had no access to. So they insisted on having access to these men's clubs. And then it wasn't that anymore, right? It was no longer a place where men could drop the censorship and speak the way they wanted to in ways that women would perceive as crude and offensive. They could no longer engage in play physical violence, you know, which all animals do, but men are now forbidden from doing that for the most part. The other thing is that it's a lot of work. It's a ton of work to organize a fishing trip, and it's expensive, and your friends are busy. You got to organize the schedule and everything. It's a lot easier to pick up your phone and watch a YouTube video of somebody else going fishing. And so the barriers became higher, and the alternatives, the barriers became lower. And so I think that men are in a very, very difficult position right now. And, you know, we're seeing that fewer of them are going to college. Medicine used to be a male profession. Now, female medical students far outnumber male medical students. And in so many areas, men are just giving up.
Yeah. This is such an important topic, and I really appreciate you giving me the time to do this. I know we're getting a little short on time, so maybe I can close with a final question, which, you know, is probably quite personal to you. What advice do you give your sons to encourage them to embrace their natures and prepare them for a life where I'm sure you hope that they can thrive? What kind of guidance? Because I have to imagine there's a lot of overlap here with your general advice to boys and men in general. What as their father, what do you tend to suggest to them or nudge them in a certain direction to help cultivate personality qualities and a lifestyle that is going to make for a great life for them?
Giving advice is hard.
Yeah.
And the reason is we're all so different. When we give advice, we tend to assume that other people are like us, you know, and I'm no different. I'm very, very much of an introvert and I love books. And so I tell them to read old books because that's where you're going to find the role models. You know, you're going to read about men who cared about virtue, who pushed themselves to be honest, to be conscientious, to take care of others. You read about men who make sacrifice for the good of other people, their family, their friends, society, their country. And I just don't see those kinds of role models so much in life. And so I say, read Charles Dickens. You know, it's a great freaking story. I don't know if you were forced to read A Tale of Two Cities in high school or anything.
I don't think so.
It's a rocking story. And there are so many examples of male virtue as well as female virtue as well. It's a very, very traditional kind of virtue, which I think that many people would criticize today. But I think that that's part of the problem. It's a kind of virtue that accords with our human nature. And human nature is not malleable in the way that many people believe it is. We've got to take it as it is and work with it. So, you know, as an introvert, as someone who loves books, that's my recommendation. I know it's not going to be right for everybody, though.
What's next for you, Daniel? What's interesting you? Where do you want to direct your time? What are you doing? What's next?
2 years ago, I left George Washington University. I was in academia for 26 years. I taught, I did research, I worked my way up the academic ladder. And 2 years ago, I jumped to the tech world. Now I run the clinical aspect of mental health for a telehealth company called Hims & Hers Health. Psychiatry is desperately needed in this country. There's a ton of mental illness and people have a terrible time trying to access good care. And I think it's the tech companies that are at the forefront of trying to solve that problem. You know, in academia, it was about what's the best possible care we can give, right? How can we move things forward and give even better care? But we were only able to treat a very tiny percentage of people. At Hims & Hers, we're trying to democratize the things that come out of academia and make them available to everybody. And so that's what I'm most excited about. I'm very much involved with artificial intelligence, but trying to find ways to take the very best medical care that there is and make that available to everybody.
Yeah. I can tell how much you care about this just in this one conversation. I really appreciate you doing this. This is such important work. Like I said earlier, thanks for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me.